Souls of Mine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. We all have bad days, but for some, almost every day is a bad one. Ongoing feelings of melancholy or depression. There could be any number of reasons for these down days, a sad or traumatic event or experience, or an actual chemical imbalance, such as general anxiety disorder, which is more common than you may be aware. Feeling blue changes in hues and tones, depending on the person and situation. Bummed, depressed, suicidal. After someone has committed suicide, those who loved him or her now live with another unique shade of blue. Since the Golden Gate Bridge opened in 1937, each year around 24 people have jumped to their death. Yeah, do that math. San Francisco is planning on constructing a suicide barrier, but until that happens, how many more will we lose? Each summer during an event called Names in the Sand, volunteers write the names into the sand of each and every person who has jumped from the bridge. Each volunteer is given a scroll with 5 to 10 names. After those names have been written, the volunteer is given another list, and so on until all have been remembered. A cousin participates in this event each year, and she said, "There's something lovely about the waves gliding on the shore, washing away the names, as if the bay is also acknowledging the lost lives." We know that celebrities aren't immune. We lost our beloved Robin Williams to suicide, and James Taylor has admitted to suicidal depression as a teenager. Shades of Blue is a collection of 35 essays, edited by Amy Ferris, which presents brutally honest, true, personal stories of everyday people dealing with his or her shade of blue. The book also offers hope, with each contributor sharing how they overcame or work around their particular issues, emotional or mental health. Three of the writers who contributed to the book, Karen Lynch, David Lacey, and Deborah Ligorcio D'Angelo, read excerpts of their essays at the independent bookstore Avid Reader in Davis, California. First up, we'll hear from Deborah Ligorcio D'Angelo, and her bio in the book reads, "She's a columnist with McNaughton Newspapers, managing editor of the award-winning weekly newspaper Winter's Express, and co-founder, co-editor, and CEO for iPinion Syndicate. She has received multiple first-place awards from the National Newspaper Association and California Newspaper Publishers Association for column writing, and was a 2002 winner of the Front Porch Syndicate's National Column Writing Talent Search. She has served as judge for the California Newspaper Publishers Association for 22 years and has written a weekly column for 24 years, covering topics ranging from humor to politics to parenting and, from time to time, cats. Deborah's columns can be found at iPinionSyndicate.com. Read more at DeborahDeAngelo.com.
Going to kind of jump into the middle of this story and just bring you up to speed a little bit about where we are so you can keep up with me. But everything that could go wrong with the mother-daughter bonding when I was born happened. I was a transverse arrest, which means I was against the cervix, against my back. So my mother was in labor 3 days, had an emergency cesarean. I immediately was born with pneumonia and went straight into an incubator and came home. And my mother was a physician in the 50s, which is a little bit of a rare thing. There were no daycares in the 50s, and so she went back to work when I was 2 weeks old. And I got bounced from caretaker to caretaker to caretaker to caretaker. It would be an aunt for 3 weeks, a grandmother for 3 weeks, and bounced along in that fashion until I was old enough for babysitters. But she and I just never bonded. And I spent a lot of my life wondering, why doesn't she love me? Why doesn't she love me? Why? And more recently, because of this book, was able to look back on it and take the emotion out of it and just accept it as a fact. This floor is green, and these are books, and my mother didn't love me. And to look at that without judging it, that it's not a statement about my own worth. It just is what it is. She just couldn't. She had a defect. I was not an easy child to bond with. They didn't find out until several years later that I was born legally blind. So I can only see about 5 inches without my contacts. I couldn't see faces, so I would look around for movement, you know, instead of making eye contact. But the odd thing about myself as an infant, and all of you who are parents will recognize this, I didn't smile until I was a year old. Now, developmentally, Babies smile at 5 months. They respond to voices, and I didn't. That's where we're going to jump in to this story, when I found out what the issue was with me. By my 20s, I'd weathered several bad relationships and a disastrous marriage. I went for counseling to talk about my emotionally abusive husband. I ended up talking about my mother. In one session, I spread out photos of me from birth until present. The therapist studied my photographic timeline and made an observation. "You've always been sad." "Sad? What does that even mean? This is how I've always felt. I can't comprehend any other way to feel." "If you're colorblind, you don't imagine colors you can't see. It's impossible. You just accept that this is how the world looks and that's that. What the hell are red or green or happy?" My therapist labeled my lifelong sadness as infantile depression. At least it gave my chronic low-grade longing a context. Every mother I'd ever had, mother, the babysitters, the aunts, the grandmothers, including my actual parent, had abandoned me. No wonder I was so wary of getting attached to anyone. I was still protecting myself. Flash forward to now. I've discovered that infantile depression is actually a symptom of something larger, reactive attachment disorder, which I've abbreviated as RAD, which results from having multiple caretakers and no stable attachments during infancy. The infant never learns to bond. Usually, you must be raised in a Romanian orphanage or bounce from foster home to foster home to develop RAD. But I developed it while being passed from the loving arms of one grandmother to the next, and aunts and babysitters, and on and on and on. An infant with RAD is withdrawn, sad, and listless, irritable for no reason. She neither seeks comfort nor responds to it. She doesn't smile. She watches others closely but doesn't engage with them. She doesn't reach out to be picked up and is disinterested in playing peekaboo or other interactive games. That's baby me. Add to this my gazing past faces I couldn't see, and nowadays I'd be whisked off for early autism intervention. Back then, my parents just called me serious and handed me to whichever caretaker was on duty. I was the serious one. My bubbly, bouncy sister, born 4 years later, was the smiley one. But she also had serial caretakers. What was different? She had me. I was a constant presence in Susie's life from day one. Caretakers came, caretakers went. But Susie smiled and made eye contact anyway. Mom finally had her dream baby. There's a photo of us that says it all. Mom is holding Susie in her lap, joyfully beaming down at her. They're gazing at each other in mutual adoration. I'm scooted right next to Mom, but her free arm isn't around me. It's tucked under her leg, and her shoulder is slightly turned, creating a protective barrier against me. Once Susie was born, I ceased to exist. Was I crazy jealous? Did I hate Susie with every fiber of my being? No. Susie was my constant presence, too. She was the first person who didn't leave me. Besides, she was amusing, a big doll that moved, drooled, and babbled. And when she smiled at me, I finally smiled back. So.
When Mommy Dearest came out, it shocked a lot of people. Like, how can anybody treat their child, even though she was adopted? How do you treat a child like that? It was just incomprehensible. So it's a shock to a lot of people when they hear their neighbor has experienced the exact same thing. Didn't have the famous parent, but had somebody, especially in the medical profession, as you mentioned.
Yeah. Well, my mom wasn't abusive. She just was unaware of me as a human being.
Well, it's not direct and intentional, but it's still.
I just really didn't exist in her world. She was focused on her career, and parenting didn't come naturally to her. And as I look at the extended family, nobody was really all that affectionate or functional. I imagine this is a legacy from back of my Viking Scottish ancestors on that side that, you know, you don't attach to the babies because they may die in the snow. So
good point.
Maybe that's it.
Food for thought.
Yeah.
Because my mom had a similar experience. She was 6 years old when her brother died of this rare form of anemia. And as a result, in their grief, she ceased to exist to her parents.
Wow.
So it's interesting to me how people deal with it differently. Some don't move past it. Others somehow, like my mother, I still to this day cannot comprehend how she became this bright, sunny personality. Did you have one of those moments when you realized, okay, no one's going to help me, so it's going to be up to me? I have to do something. Do you remember, was there a specific moment or a...
It was focused more on my really horrible first marriage, which I entered into because I was not able to recognize healthy relationships or what love was. I thought it was stable, but I married an alcoholic, just like I had grown up with my father. But there was a moment when I was working in social services and realizing, oh, I have issues. I should go to some adult children of alcoholics meetings. And it was a specific moment in a guided meditation. And it was about going back to see your inner child. Well, my inner child was in a burning house. And I had the distinct idea pop in my head of, we need to get out of here right now or we're going to die. And so while other people are doing fun things with their inner child, I was taking mine out of a burning building. And it was like a recognition. I must get out of this marriage or I'll die. And step by step, I got out of it and kind of pieced myself back together. And it helps to be older. I mean, I was close to 40. Being middle-aged gives you more perspective when you suddenly realize I'm not at the mercy of everyone else. I can choose where I go, and I can choose who I'm with and who's in my life and who's not. So...
Did you find any particular type of counseling that helped a little bit?
The Adult Children of Alcoholics meetings, which was a 12-step meeting, was very helpful. At the time, I was working in a social services agency where we were doing a lot of mental health things and counseling, and just being around all these people who were so functional, I was immersed in good mental health. I was immersed in good communication. So my work ended up being a therapy of sorts. When I'm there trying to help clients with self-esteem and realizing, but my self-esteem's in the toilet. So it became therapeutic, and I got bolder, and I jumped into journalism thinking I'd be a screenwriter, and that sort of didn't happen. But private counseling helps. I mentioned tapping therapy, EFT therapy, is amazingly helpful. On tapping.com, you can get a taste of it for free, and you can see a result right there. Just giving it a try. It sounds crazy, but acupuncture sounds crazy. So I think anyone with stress or depression or chronic emotional issues could benefit from it. Super helpful.
And talking about it helps quite a bit too.
Talking helps. Getting older helps. Taking toxic people out of your life.
That can be more challenging than...
Well, you can have a litmus test. When you're with someone, do you feel energized or drained? Do you feel better or do you feel sick? And if you feel drained or sick after spending time with that person, these are the people you need to cut out of your life. It's more problematic if they're relatives.
Well, that's what I meant by challenging. Sometimes right. It's not that easy to just walk away. If it's a so-called friend, you just stop calling. You just stop seeing them.
I have broken up with friends for my own emotional health.
Yep.
And it sounds weird, but
I have as well.
You can do it.
You just got to leave.
Yeah, and... They sometimes don't understand why, but also you get to the age where I don't even have to explain why. I just need to leave.
Yep.
For my own sanity. So
I don't like confrontation. I don't seek it out, and I don't see the need for the drama, so I just simply leave.
Right.
And
exit stage left.
Yeah. And 4 out of 5 times, they don't follow.
Yeah.
They don't even make the effort, which is another litmus test that they weren't really invested in the relationship.
Right. Well, a lot of those relationships are toxic to begin with. So sometimes other people are in relationships because they're getting something out of it. Then you might hear from them because they want to get what they were getting. But
like an
sorry,
addiction.
The store's closed.
Now, what did you find with this book and reading other people's essays? Anything that registered and clicked with you? Like, oh, yeah.
Some people have lived through things that are obviously traumatic and stressful and unimaginable, whether it's been their own experience or a loved one or a spouse, but they've lived through amazing things. And I read about horrific depression to the point of wanting to die, which I was never that way. I am not suicidal. I'm too anxiety-ridden to be suicidal. So learning about what that mental process is was kind of a shock, but I learned that there is a whole spectrum of these shades of blue. My story, in my opinion, is at the baby blue end. Some of these other stories are deep indigo and everything in between, but the thing we all have in common is that none of us were talking about it. And so now we're talking about it. Whatever a reader's shade of blue, there's a place to jump in. There's a place where you can say, yeah, I'm on that spectrum. I'm right there.
There's a tribe.
Yes, a tribe. A blue tribe. Yeah, they made a movie about that once. It was called Avatar.
Only this is real action figures.
Only this is real action figures. And I wish I had cat teeth, but such is life.
Next one. Next life. Next one. They've got 9 lives after all, so you can do it again. Do over.
With teeth.
And now we'll hear from David Lacey, and his bio in the book reads that he began writing for a Daly City newspaper when he was 15, covering county politics, features, and occasionally sports. In 2003, his weekly column, Growing Younger, won first place in the California Newspaper Publishers Association's Better Newspapers contest. He has a BA in English from UC Davis and an MA in English from UC Irvine. He's written for multiple magazines and newspapers. He is a full-time writing specialist and former lecturer at UC Irvine and part-time professor at Orange Coast College. He has also taught at CSU Long Beach. David is the co-founder of iOpinionSyndicate.com, an online column and blogging site. The Northern California native now resides in Orange County, California, with his fiance and 2 dogs.
Passage from the very beginning of my essay called Allies in the Sky. After my ex-wife moved out, I flew to my hometown to visit family and friends nearly every other weekend. This was difficult because I was terrified of flying. As soon as we reached cruising altitudes, I'd order 2 miniature bottles of Tarte Airline Chardonnay for the 1-hour flight between Southern and Northern California. The wine, of course, chased the pre-flight Xanax, dusty pills that slid out of a bottle with a warning label that read, "Do not mix with alcohol." Some people who are afraid of flying will never voluntarily take the window seat. I needed it. As soon as the plane took off, I pressed my temple firmly against the glass and stared intently at the receding features of the earth. I somehow believed that if I remained acutely focused on the rattles and bumps of the flight, I could control it, thereby ensuring the continued levitation of a massive airborne cylinder of steel traveling at speeds in excess of 400 miles per hour. A teacher of mine once referred to this as magical thinking. My psychiatrist has a different phrase for it, a symptom of my generalized anxiety disorder. He's the one who supplied me with his Xanax, though, so I'll go with his terminology. I desired the window seat for an additional reason. I wanted, needed, to scout for planes. Scanning the skies, I would search compulsively for little specks of metal crisscrossing the horizons. Somehow, and I still have difficulty explaining this to people, I found solace in the companionship of other moving airplanes. Their presence, along with the Xanax and the shitty kids here, Chardonnay, steadied my nerves in a curious way. Clearly, they could be of no aid in case of an emergency, but spotting them out there, planes full of humans floating below, above, and around me, made me feel more secure. When one flew slightly out of sight, I'd ball up my fist anxiously, my eyes frantically searching for the next plane. In my head, I referred to them as airplane allies, and I didn't truly comprehend their powers until recently. Even when you know it's coming, you don't really know. I say moved out, but if there were a more clinical way to describe my wife's departure, I'd use that term instead. Before I left for a friend's house that weekend, a mutually agreed upon time where my wife's parents would help their daughter pack up without having to experience the pained and embarrassing confrontation with a son-in-law they had known for nearly a decade, we had drawn up a his and hers list. I didn't return until I was sure they had gone, confirmed with a text, and as I unlocked the same stubborn lock I had battled with daily for years, I stepped into an apartment that was exactly half empty. The surgical precision with which our home had been bisected and vacated was remarkable. There were exactly half as many electronics, half as many dishes, half as many Pottery Barn furnishings. She was nothing if not judicious. I walked slowly to the center of the living room, sweeping my head from side to side, seeking something but unsure what. Suddenly, I felt a heavy pressure, as if I had been immured into the space between 2 repelling magnets, and I dropped to the floor. I doubled over, crossed my arms over my chest, and clenched my fists. I began rocking back and forth and breathing faster, sucking sips of air in increasingly quick, fierce intervals. When the numb tingling began prickling my face, neck, and arms, I knew a panic attack was imminent. The sips became gulps, and the tremulous sobs began. The ugly, twisted, thick, labored sobs, each ending in a deep moan and mumbling lips that offered an incoherent plea over and over again in a broken record fashion, please no. Tears streamed from my eyes and merged with viscous snot. What I remember most vividly is that no one was there. I spent the remainder of the evening completely alone. I woke in a daze, unmoved, from that selfsame spot on the floor. I reached out without lifting my head, grabbed my phone, and checked the time. It was 11:45 p.m. I had slept through the entire day. Now I had the rest of the night to contend with. I pulled myself up with considerable effort and went in search of Benadryl. I found two in my bathroom medicine cabinet. I didn't even bother looking on her side. I already knew what wasn't there. Tossed the pink tablets in my mouth, stuck my head under the faucet, and swallowed. I returned to nearly the exact same spot where I passed out earlier and curled back up on the floor. I've never stared at the base of a wall for so long. Memories played on loop in my mind, the intractable anxieties that had chipped at a relationship for years, shaving away small pieces of trust and security, one compulsive thought at a time. More nights, just like this, came and went, never reorganizing the furniture into a functional living pattern, never throwing clothes in hampers, simply tossing articles into a corner of the room that quickly developed a stench, never buying food, never eating, never hungry. It was as if the pendulum of self-restraint had swung in the other direction, from a fierce compulsion to regulate every minutia of my existence to apathetic abandon. My therapist, Dr. Tai, had accumulated 2 decades of my crazy into a generic manila folder. My unconscious need to control bound together with notes chronicling anxiety, obsessive thoughts, and male anorexia. I set the alarm on my phone, curled up on the floor, and attempted to make it through the next fitful night. I would leave for work early, move through my days in a haze, and come home to repeat the same chores that felt more arduous than they were, which amounted to the bare minimum, showering and changing my clothes. My fridge remained stocked with a box of wine and a collection of half-used condiments. In less than 2 weeks, I was practically climbing the walls in desperation. I needed to get the hell out. It gets upbeat after that.
So I read that 3.1% of the country, which is over 6 million people, are having to deal with anxiety disorder. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. You know, I hear people all the time saying, oh, that book is out of order. I'm so OCD. Sort of simplifying a problem that, for, like you said, millions of people is very real and far more crippling than that. If you're not dealing with it, there's no doubt that it's 1 to 2 degrees of separation away from you.
So those ragers on the freeway, there might be a reason behind it.
There might be. And of course, not to excuse the ragers on the freeway, absolutely not. I do think it calls to mind empathy and understanding of anything that someone might be going through. Why is someone having this very atypical reaction? Most often, there is a reason behind that.
And it isn't necessarily something that would be diagnosed, because it could be in the lower end of the spectrum, and people just think, oh, she just flies off the handle.
Exactly. Thank you for understanding spectrum, which I knew you would. You have people on one end. When we think of people with anxiety disorders, we think of rocking back and forth, all sorts of compulsions. And I've seen that. I have family members that go all the way at that end of the spectrum. And then we have people, especially whether they're medicated or not, that are more, I guess you could say, high functioning. And you'd be less suspect that person was dealing with it. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about having it run in the family, a mm-hmm. genetic predisposal, as it were. Where were you in the lineup of people in your family, chronologically speaking? Older, younger?
So of my blood siblings, half and real, I'm the oldest. I have some step-siblings as well. And without saying who dealt with what, to save some anonymity, most of them dealt with some things. Most of them dealt with anxiety. Some have dealt with bipolar disorder. My father, I know he's mentioned this before, so I'm okay sharing this. He has that very stereotypical OCD of the hand-washing, did I lock the door, over and over again. Sometimes people think it's funny to make fun of, but actually it's pretty crippling in the mind to the person that's dealing with it.
Howard Hughes, of course, is a prime example.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And that's him as well. Yes,
and it's nothing to do with intelligence.
I know everybody likes to say, oh, my dad's the greatest, smartest guy ever. My dad is a tremendously well-read individual and tremendously intelligent. People are dealing with this regardless of where they're at. Whether it's this, bipolar, depression, it has nothing to do with education levels. I guess there are some studies showing that people in high-pressure situations and low-income situations might succumb to it for various reasons. But otherwise, it's colorblind and genderblind. And
One thing it is, it's been my observation, I've had my moments, is that we have a higher sense of awareness, an acute sense of awareness. So we'll be more sensitive when we walk into a room if an argument has just occurred there, if everybody's really happy.
Yeah.
And we're just responding in kind. We're acclimating to whatever's going on there. And if your brain was somewhere else before you walked into that room, maybe that acclimation isn't happening as quickly as you'd like it.
Absolutely. It sounds weird to people who haven't experienced it, but I do sometimes feel like I'm actually picking up on things. And sometimes I reach too far, and I think I'm picking up on something, and I read too much into it. And that's where the disorder really gets crippling. You read too much into a situation. I've made people uncomfortable with how much I've predicted about how they were feeling before, you know, and I'm not a psychic or anything like that.
Intuition, though.
Yeah, it's just you feel like something is off and you can sense it. But then again, the flip side of that is then you begin reading too much into it. And especially once you start pointing that back at yourself, oh, I wonder if it has anything to do with me. I wonder what I did wrong or what. So
trying to look for answers.
Yeah, precisely.
Which aren't always there.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes things just are.
And that's the hardest thing for me is that I paint the biggest, most catastrophic scenarios in my head.
But how creative have you gotten?
Well, part of that, I won't share the worst, but believing I have my first panic attack, I believe it was a small stroke. I justified it by saying it was one of those minor TIA strokes.
How old were you?
That was right before graduate school started. It took a while for my first panic attack. Male anorexia in terms of distortion of body image. HIV, just because I'd had a very normal, healthy sexual encounter, I thought I must have gotten it. Cancer, repeatedly. You take the things that some people do, where they do that compulsive searching for information, and they come up with an overbearing answer to it, and I do that way too frequently. Yeah. And there's one more example I'm going to hold off on until I write about it. Because it's way
stay
out
tuned
there.
For the memoir!
Exactly, yeah.
One thing I love about these TED Talks is that there are people speaking on various subjects, including depression and mental illness, which is fabulous because it's another way of getting people talking. Mm-hmm. And shades of blue, because there are so many different shades. And back in the day, if you were feeling down, you'd be told, oh, suck it up, move on. Well, clearly that doesn't work. You can't just brush it off if you fell out of a tree.
Yeah.
That doesn't work either. The beauty and the pull and the attraction for me of shades of blue is I've had those experiences where I go to bed and just, you know, if I don't wake up in the morning, that would be lovely. Can I just ask the universe, please, just, I'm done, I'm tired, I have nothing left, I'm tapped out. That you have different writers, different experiences, but there's a commonality.
Yeah, and there's a commonality, and there are these people that you don't expect that they would be dealing with these particular. So with a lot of the people that are in there, they look like these very professional people. Anyone, you should never just be saying, hey, buck up, snap out of it. And we do this even more with people that are high functioning and they've got these professional jobs. We definitely think those people should be able to, you know, get over it. Fortunately, more and more people are understanding that it's not like that. That's quite literally the same as telling a person with a broken leg to walk it off. And it's not working. Taking that approach hasn't worked, and finally people are starting to talk about it differently.
Those of us that are caregivers, we want to just fix people, and we can't always do that.
Yeah.
So I think the best suggestion that you could give someone who knows somebody who is dealing with something is just listen.
Absolutely. Unless you're a therapist, and even they listen. The most well-meaning advice often comes off distorted to a person with anxiety.
Preachy, knowing it all.
Absolutely preachy, knowing it all, or you can't truly relate to this. And so, but listening is one thing that we would always appreciate.
You're being acknowledged that you exist.
And I promise I would do it for other, I do it for other people.
And your fingers aren't crossed.
Nope, they're in my pockets because it's cold. They were doing this interview outside, but they're not crossed.
Karen Lynch was a homicide investigator for San Francisco Police Department, and prior to being promoted, she worked as a street patrol officer for 9 years. After 29 years of police work and a bout with breast cancer, she retired to become a full-time writer. Her 2014 memoir, Good Cop, Bad Daughter, Memoirs of an Unlikely Police Officer, tells the story of how being raised by a bipolar mother and a tribe of hippies provided her the perfect training to become a cop. She is a native San Franciscan and proud UC Berkeley Cal Bear. She has been married to Greg for 25 years, with whom she has 3 children. Here's Karen.
It's called Thorazine. When I was 7, my mother taught me how to kill myself. She said you must hold the gun firmly to your temple and squeeze the trigger without hesitation. Don't be a wimp about it. The bullet will pierce the soft flesh of your temple, travel through the occipital lobe, and take out the executive suite of your brain. Maybe she didn't say executive suite, but her words made me picture a Wall Street financier doing the deed in his private office bathroom. Mom said those who failed to follow these simple instructions risked leaving themselves alive and hideously deformed. Hideously, she emphasized. Mom shared other useful insights she had acquired along the way, such as her certainty that she could perform a competent emergency tracheotomy using just a steak knife should we ever be dining out and I begin choking. Though Mom had spent a great deal of time in psychiatric hospitals, I probably don't need to say here that Mom had no formal medical training. She was an autodidactic physician. I hate to sound like one of those I blame my parents for everything people, but her offer to perform surgery is the probable source of my neurotic phobia of steak knives, restaurants, and meat. We never owned firearms during my childhood, which was a good thing given Mom's history. Nonetheless, the vivid picture of my self-inflicted headshot made cameo appearances as I grew older. I had never touched a firearm until I became a police recruit, nor had I ever seen one in the hands of any of the hippie tribe who raised me. But Mom was so detailed in her instructions, at times it seemed she hoped I might somehow acquire a revolver and do myself in. Mom's Thorazine came in a jumbo bottle, similar in size to a Costco bottle of ibuprofen that might last an average family 10 years. When she took the medication, our life was calm and relatively predictable. I would take the bus to school, then return home to find Mom where I'd left her, harmlessly perched in bed, reading historical novels and smoking cartons of Marlboro Lights. I loved the periods in our life when she took her meds. Small lozenges of tranquility that kept the dreaded manic episodes at bay. But as inevitable as the changing of the seasons, Mom would stop taking her Thorazine, saying she hated the side effects of lethargy and weight gain. I pretended everything would miraculously be okay, convincing myself that she no longer needed the medication. However, within a few weeks off Thorazine, Mom's mania would return, the upside to her being bipolar, and then all bets were off. Mom might then lock herself in the bathroom, hollering that she was slashing her wrists. There was never any actual slashing, no blood or razors to be found. Her screaming was only a gesture designed to manipulate me into calling her ex-boyfriend to save her. Reliably, I would call him, playing my part in Mom's script, and Jim would arrive stage left, the Colt 45 drinking, Pall Mall smoking, white knight in a Chevy pickup. Mom had achieved her desired reaction, never intending to voluntarily remove herself from the planet. Like those who test positive for a disease, never showing any symptoms, Mom was a suicide carrier, not a victim. When the time finally comes, I will disregard Mom's vivid instructions. Having no access to a firearm and no desire to make myself hideously ugly in the event of failure, I will choose the most obvious and convenient of escape routes.
So when you have a parent who, in your case, has bipolar, how do you deal with that when you're a child? Is there some point or some age when you feel like you're responsible, you have to take care of her, in addition to yourself, and you age rather quickly?
Yeah, I think that would be a fair assessment. I probably realized at about age 5 or so that I was pretty much on my own and that I was going to have to, you know, figure out how to survive. And pretty much a mantra throughout my childhood was just survive my childhood, and I knew if I made it through childhood, I would be okay. But it was tough at times because she wanted me to be her friend more than her daughter and her companion and travel mate. So it was challenging.
Did you have to go through a lot of different schools?
I went to a number of schools, but not as many as I might have. For some reason, we moved quite a bit. We moved about 20 times during my childhood. But usually I ended up in the same school district. So I changed schools more than the average kid, but not as many times as we moved. But my mother took me all over the world. She took me to Japan, she took me to England, and part of her disease was that she would, when she was manic, she wanted to travel. So she would take whatever money she had stowed away and take me somewhere or have a boyfriend finance our trip, and then we would end up somewhere, and quite often I would end up in some kind of a children's home, and she would end up in a mental hospital in some other country, things like that. So that was sort of a theme of my childhood.
So did you have one of those childhoods where you just assumed a lot of kids had lives like that? Or are you aware that there was something wrong?
Yeah, I think I fantasized that the rest of America lived something like Leave It to Beaver or like the television shows that we saw during the 50s and 60s. And so I was a child mostly in the 60s, and there were so many of those sitcoms like Donna Reed and Father Knows Best and all this. So I thought that was kind of normal, and I thought that my family was very abnormal. And so I decided if I could just be like those people that I watched on these television shows, if I could sort of pretend to be normal, then maybe I could be perceived as being normal by other people, and I could hide the fact that I had this embarrassingly horrible home life.
I remember I was in sixth grade and Francine Avenetti, and she wanted to show me something at home, but she made me wait outside first. And I thought it was very odd, and then she came back, she's okay, my dad's not here.
Wow.
And I found out later that he had a serious drinking problem.
Oh, yeah.
That was my first introduction.
Yes.
To something. Now, speaking of friends, how old were you when you had your first real friend that you were able to connect with ongoing?
My best friend, I guess, from childhood, and I met when we were seven. And she also came from a goofy family. She had a single mom who worked a lot of hours, and so she was left alone at home to her own devices quite a bit. And so the two of us just really had the run of San Francisco. We would go everywhere and go to the library, go to the beach, go to the parks. And we really had very little supervision. And it was kind of nice because I guess you'd call it now a free-range child. But in those days, parents didn't seem to worry that much that their kids would be kidnapped. Or in our case, maybe they wished we would be. I don't know.
What day is it?
Yeah. So that was great. And she and I remained friends for many, many years, for decades. We were close friends.
Did you ever have a discussion before you got married about, are you going to pass this on to your children?
I don't think I realized that I had a problem until I tell it in the story that it really hit me when I was in my mid-30s. And we'd already had our two boys by then, and our third child is adopted. But at the time that we got married, which was 25 years ago, I don't think I fully appreciated the genetic aspect of mental illness. So I don't think that I assumed that it would be passed on. I think I knew it was partially genetic, but I assumed that there was some environmental factors that I could control with my kids.
And your mother had that and you had it, you didn't...
Well, I didn't know that I had any... I did not have the same diagnosis as my mother. My mother was bipolar, and I had sort of a generic anxiety disorder. And I didn't really realize I had it until I had already had my kids. So by then it was, you know, a done deal.
And did your mother attempt suicide?
No, she would, like I said in that story, she was a carrier, not like
I know,
a,
I
like,
love that phrase.
Like a disease carrier. No, she made everybody around her want to kill themselves, and she has miraculously outlived everyone. But no, she never really made a real attempt, I would say no. I mean, she would sit in the bathtub and scream and say she was slashing her wrists, but she never actually did that.
But she's in a home now, you said?
She's in a assisted care facility, a nursing facility.
You know, you can always tell somebody's of a certain age when we say phrases like home, and I have to catch myself, because they're called assisted care facilities now.
Oh, right, yeah.
Although home sounds better. You know,
I guess,
I think they used to call it that because it made them feel better.
Yeah.
Well, she's going to a home.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I never really thought about the difference, and I guess, yeah.
The terminology really can make a difference. It's more than semantics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how old are your kids now?
23, 20, and 14.
And are they all okay?
Yes, they're doing great. Thank you.
You probably had some really nice, deep discussions with them at some point.
We've talked a little bit about it. When I wrote the book, then they...
Well, that's what I was thinking when you wrote the book. It would be open discussions.
Yeah, I wrote the book after I got the cancer diagnosis and after going through the treatment and everything. And I just really felt like, you know, life is short, and I wanted my kids to understand why I had no relationship with my mother. And also I wanted them to understand what it was like for the first women cops who came in through the department at the time that I did. And I felt like, you know, I'd always wanted to tell my story, and so I sat down and I wrote it. And so once I wrote it, then I had to tell them some of what was going to be in it. And, you know, they were different ages, and each of them was interested to a different degree. Some of them were more interested than others. So.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. And it's fine. You know, I figure it's something when I'm long gone, they may want to read it or not. You know, who knows?
Now, how old were you when you entered law enforcement?
22.
What was your impetus for doing so?
The reason I went into law enforcement was partially motivated, I think, by feminism. You know, at the time, they were opening the doors to women for the first time. And there was a lot of belief by the public that women were too emotional and weak to be good law enforcement officers. And I think that really bothered me. And I also needed a career. And so it just, the timing was just right.
Now, does an anxiety disorder that ever enter the picture impede it or help it?
I think anxiety is such an ingrown part of law enforcement that you almost don't even notice it. I think it probably attracts a lot of people who have varying degrees of anxiety issues because you can get comfortable sitting on a tack, you know, anything will, you get used to anything. So if you're used to having a lot of anxiety in your life, and that's really the theme of my book, how my mother's disorder kind of trained me to be a cop, in a sense. I was so used to having things be unpredictable and not know what she was going to do next, that it wasn't that strange for me to go into a profession that was very unpredictable.
So why did you finally exit stage left?
I retired because of the cancer. I had had 29 years in, and I was more than 50. I was 50 at that time, and my daughter was 8. And I thought, you know, life is short, and I can retire, and I can write. I've always wanted to write, and I'm obviously not going to get it done as long as I'm working full-time.
Writing reports there.
Right, exactly. So that was the motivation.
There truly is hope. Do something different. During your travels, learn about a community by visiting its independent bookstore, and you'll definitely discover items not found in bookstore chains.